Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who's going to be performing this entire episode all oiled up and playing a saxophone. It's Tom Trezimer.
Hip thrusting and pelvic moves and
I still believe.
Oh, man. Tina Turner's saxophonist.
Tom Capello. Tim Capello.
Yeah, that's nuts. I mean, that guy, he was a big musician at the time. He had toured the world, and they just brought him in to do this thing. I mean, That crowd loved that guy. Did they not?
He is like a beefed-up version of Kenny G mashed with the vocals of...
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, man. George Michael, and Whoa. He looks like Bret Hart. That guy is something else.
With the hair of Shawn Michaels.
Yes. The hair of Shawn Michaels. That's better than Bret Hart. There you go. He's a saxophone playing Shawn Michaels.
People just... what I love so much about that scene is how much people love it. And unironically, that's what I like about this movie that Joel Schumacher made, The Lost Boys, is that this movie is not... It's not pretentious. It's not ironic. It's just a straightforward... there's some comedy in it. There's some meta... narratives in here, but it's just an unpretentious, fun 95-minute movie that goes by quickly. And what's pretty wild, man, is I didn't know so I always knew this movie was popular, but when you brought this up, I always dive into a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And I started learning about how much there is out there about this movie. There's books, there's documentaries, the commentaries on the DVD, the articles 30 years later, 20 years later. Just talking about the ideals of family. Whenever vampire movies come up, there's the argument that it kickstarted vampire movies. It's still relevant today, very much so. And people really talk about it. And I think that all comes down to some of the very smart decisions that Joel Schumacher made when he took over the project.
Well, and that's kind of interesting, too, because originally it wasn't a Joel Schumacher movie. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a Richard Donner movie. Like, so it was almost like, yeah, exactly. It was supposed to be a bunch of fifth, sixth graders, and the Edgar and Alan Frog Brothers were supposed to be these chubby Cub Scout boys. And so then I guess Donner bailed on it. Production started to halt, and it came to a grinding stop, and Donner jumped to Lethal Weapon and handed this off to Schumacher, who wanted to make a sexy vampire movie.
Yeah.
And that's what we got.
That was a smart move. Donner also said that he had been living with it so long, it wasn't interesting to him anymore. And that's actually happened to me. Sometimes when I'm doing a podcast episode, it keeps getting delayed months and months and months. It's been with me so long, the episode's kind of flat. So I get why he kind of stepped away from that. But yeah, just the decisions to lean less heavily towards... You sent me that really cool Stan Winston article about how the initial makeup for Kiefer and crew... was very monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
But they went away from that, and they made it more human. And I don't know, man. Listen, it's a Schumacher movie, but it's... I think it's a lot of fun. It's There's just so much pouting looks. There's glowering in it. There's
It's a 95-minute MTV movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is. I mean, just the music that's in there, Listen, if you took a shot every time one of the vampires laughed, or they said, Michael, you'd be dead, too.
Oh, yes. I think I found a random article that lists the name, that says that the name Michael was dropped in this movie anywhere from 114 to 118 times.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you took a shot for that, you would die. You would not make it to the final showdown.
And then just when they're laughing, these vampires laugh a lot.
There's a lot of monstrous laughs in it. Like, you think of the Dr. Evil laughs, like, this is where it came from.
And also, the vampire... So you had some questions about this, right? Just the vampire mythology in this. So we have... Okay, so we have the ball... What's the word? The head vampire, but there's a word for it. I have it in my notes. I have way too many notes here. There's the head vampire. And then there is... the people that he has turned, his lost boys, Peter Pan.
Yeah, like his subordinates, yeah.
And you, I think that blood is his, correct? So they drink his blood to...
That's what I think, but that's never really... Because in the movie, even Jason Patrick's Michael Emerson asks Star, was that David's blood? And she says yes. So I'm really not sure if it's David's or if it is Max's.
Yeah.
Who is supposedly the head vampire. I think that's one thing that's kind of left ambiguous, and maybe the sequels dive into that a little more than what this does.
I guess
it
doesn't...
Which, for the fans out there, what, there are three sequels or two?
I think there's two sequels.
Two sequels and then a graphic novel.
Oh, man. I guess it could be David's blood, because, I mean, you drink a vampire's blood.
Mm-hmm.
But then does that make him your brood?
That's what I'm not sure. Kind of the... It brings up these really interesting questions of the vampire mythology,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't necessarily answer them either. Which I think is kind of fascinating, because it's not trying to answer them.
No.
I mean, it's literally just dumping us into the world like Sam and Michael are being dumped into it.
I don't think Joel Schumacher had any urge to dig further into their mythos. I think he just wanted
That's a
to
good
make
point.
I think he just wanted to show the allure of the vampires, to show the different family dynamic. You know, the way Corey Haim was dressed in this was like a mall kid. They wanted him like a
yes.
mall kid gone wrong. So I think he was more into the characters, the look. I mean, he was a costume designer for Woody Allen. So he, mm-hmm. like the outfits in this movie, I think he was more concerned with that, I would think. And there's nothing wrong with it. But I don't think we're at, like, I know we're jumping right into it, but with this Lost Boys, I don't think there's any questions that we're asking that are bad questions. We're not... Does that make sense? It's not that... Why? That makes no sense. This is more, do you think this causes A causes B? Does that
yes,
make sense?
Yes, it's kind of the domino effect of everything.
So when did you first watch this movie, and why did you suggest it?
Oh, man, I'm trying to think when I first watched this. It had to be mid-90s when I first saw this movie.
Wow, so I think young time.
I think it's... I honestly think it's probably kicked back to the days of kind of the young Brat Pack.
Yeah.
And I know Kiefer wasn't part of that, but it kind of, Emilio Estevez was. And so what I'm thinking happened with the chain of events is I was huge into Young Guns and Young Guns 2, which we covered.
Mm-hmm.
And I got stuck on a Kiefer Sutherland kick, and it led me from like Flatliners. And then I kept going backward. And then I eventually got to this movie.
Got it. And it's just, it's fun. It's so different, I guess, from vampires too, because what, in 82, you had The Hunger with, Sarandon and Bowie,
mm-hmm.
and that was Tony Scott. It was very sumptuous. It was very adult, right? And then you have Fright Night in 85, which is meta. You have the old school horror host. You have the Vampire Next Door. I mean, but that took it into the modern era. It really did. I mean, movies before sure had done that, but I think Fright Night opened up a night's door with its success and critical acclaim. And then Lost Boys sort of kicked that open, I would say, because, yeah, Fright Night opened up some doors for modern vampires, but this introduced brand new type of what a vampire could be, I would say.
Yeah, it brought in that sexy look that Schumacher was going
yeah.
for. I mean, we never really had that before. And mm-hmm. I've never, you know, maybe the MFF fans don't know, but I'm not a big horror fan. Unless there's action and explosions in it, I'm probably not going to watch it. And thankfully, The Lost Boys has both of those elements So I'll dive into it.
Now, you love Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I do love that. I do like that movie.
Yeah. I mean,
But it's interesting. Like, I'm not a huge horror fan, so I don't know a lot about vampire movies outside of, you know, what came from Lost Boys and onward. So anything before that, I don't know that well. So just the research I was looking at, it seemed like there were a bunch of Dracula movies that came out in the 70s.
Yeah.
And a lot of those were also foreign films. And then kind of the 80s hit around, and there wasn't that much that came out. Like you said, it was Fright Night that made it big. Catherine Bigelow had a movie, Near Dark, I think,
mm-hmm.
which I've never seen, and I don't think that...
Bill Paxton, it's
huge.
Good.
I don't think that had a huge impact at the box office.
Mm-mm.
And so then it finally came around to 87 with this movie, and it did. It brought vampires into like a whole new younger generation of people.
You know what? I guess I got to switch it around a little bit, because we covered Near Dark on the pod, and the vampires in that movie are just basically gypsies that travel around in an RV, but they are stylish. They're cool. They're cool. There's a scene where they murder these people in this bar, and they're very, I don't know, it's a very stylized scene, and they turn this young guy kind of they want to turn him into a vampire. Then there's a lady there. So, yeah, I mean, but they weren't teenagers. It wasn't an MTV movie. It was an R-rated, like, violent movie that, like, just, it wasn't like The Lost Boys at all. So I could see how The Lost Boys kicked open that door.
But Near Dark came out in 87 as well, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it did.
Okay. So I wonder if, I don't know, it makes me wonder, like, we've kind of talked before about movies that are similar coming out around the same time. So I wonder if, I mean, this thing, Lost Boys had been in the works for several years with Richard Donner, and then Schumacher took over. So I'm wondering if that had a little bit of impact with Near Dark and their designs with their vampires.
I don't think so. Like, that Near Dark's vampires changed because Schumacher took over? Is that
what
you're saying?
I mean, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch. I'm just wondering if it inspired them to go younger or a little different look, kind of, as you said, the hip, cool look.
Man, well, all right, so they're not hip and cool. They're just murderers. They're basically serial killers on the road, and they're having fun with it. Does that make sense? They're not like young, sexy teenagers in it. They'll murder you.
Okay, so they're not young, cool. They're not Kiefer Sutherland, Alec Winter cool.
Yeah, exactly. They're not that, but they are...
Alex Winter, I'm sorry.
But they are a variation, like, they're a new type of vampire, but they're completely different, I would say. I mean, these ones just drive around in an RV. They're not trying, they wouldn't woo Michael. They would walk into a room and slit your throat and drink all your blood.
They don't have dirt bikes.
No, they do not. They just have an RV, and they're not dirt biking in horrible fog trying to drive people off cliffs, I would say. And I guess in the 70s, we're looking at vampire movies. So you had Werner Herzog's Nosferatu remake. You had Dracula, directed by Badham, 79. I think, oh man, who starred in that? I want to say Langella. I could look that up. But you had Blackula. You had Ganja and Hess. Martin, directed by Romero. So you had zombie movies, right? But, I'm sorry, vampire movies. Now, I know people are screaming at their radio right now. You don't know about horror, but I guess what we're saying is, in 87, The Lost Boys, with their variation of vampires, sort of changed what people thought vampires could be. Because then look at what Buffy came out,
exactly.
5 years later. I mean, that Night of the Comet. Have you seen Night of the Comet?
I have not.
I watched it, and we covered it on the podcast, and I went, wow. Like, I was like, this is Buffy. And I researched it, and so he basically drew inspiration from Night of the Comet in this movie to make Buffy. So I would say it opened up the door for a younger high school vampires. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. Like, and I completely agree with you.
And it's, you know, Fright Night did have high schoolers, but they were kind of gawky and no one believed them, but it wasn't, there weren't Hellmouse and there weren't father figure vampire, a main vampire who turned, you know, these little, I guess everything just led to this and they kicked the door open. So yeah. So before people free the vampire mythology, I've talked about this a lot on the podcast and movies. It gets quite convoluted, but there's certain movies that I think are influencers, I would say.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is a big influencer.
Oh, man, it's just, just watching it, man, it's, I mean, they had the cinematographer from Taxi Driver and Raging
Bull. Chapman.
Yeah, Michael Chapman. I mean, they brought in one of the best cinematographers. They brought in an excellent production designer, Bo Welch, to play it. They found a great location to shoot at. And, I mean, what, an $8.5 million? So this is about a $20 million budgeted film. But I think they do a good job with their budget, would you say?
Oh, I think they do a great job. And, I mean, what's really fascinating, too, is that we've already kind of touched on the music in it. But they've got some big-time artists that have songs in this movie. And, I mean, it was kind of a quid pro quo type of thing where I think they got the rights to play some of these songs and use some of these, you know, musicians. And in turn, Schumacher was supposed to direct some of their music videos.
Yeah.
As far as I know, he only directed NXS's Devil Inside. But it's like that's part of the reason that they got NXS to even be in this movie. So I think they were also, in that regard, also very smart with how they spent their money.
So I have a question for you. Why do you think people still really hold on to this movie? Three reasons why people might still really love this movie.
One, I think the influencer that we've already talked about, that pretty much since then, a lot of vampire movies, you can find somehow that they've been inspired by The Lost Boys. Whether it's young, you know, they're sexy looking, they've got that like that rock and roll
Twilight
party lifestyle. Yeah, and then you got the Twilight stuff. Two, I think how creative it is, especially with the camera work and the use of music in this movie. And then I'm going to go three for me anyways, of how reserved everything is in this movie up until the final maybe 20 minutes when it just literally, for lack of a better term, goes batshit crazy.
And Grandpa saves the day.
Old Gramps. Bernard Hughes.
He's known about them for years. And then they had a post-credit scene that was taken out where Max had been around for a long time. So
yeah,
the grandpa, the entire time he's setting up stakes in the background in this movie. He's just ready. He knows what's going on, doesn't he?
He knows what's going on, but he's not telling any of his family, which I find kind of maddening, too.
Yeah,
grandpa, you've known about this. Even the last line of the movie is you confessing to hating all the vampires, but yet you didn't really help anyone until you showed up and drove your vehicle through the front door of your own house.
And
killed Max.
And could have killed everyone in the house with
That's
those
true.
Stakes, but they nailed Max perfectly.
It's a good
Maybe
shot.
He's just so good at it now.
He's
I do love that scene.
While.
I love in the background when he's making stakes and putting it into the ground. And he has his entire... I want his subplot in a movie, just the way he's dealing with it. Oh, I love it. But what do you think about... like? So I read an article where they talk about how this kind of messes with... it's hinges on repudiations and reversals of the nuclear family structure, with perhaps the best example coming from the character of Max, tall and bookish. He's Lucy's love interest, favorably observing throughout the film that Lucy has a generous nature and is a protecting mother. But he's just looking for a nuclear family? But you have a single mom who moved away and she's hustling for work, but then you have a guy that just wants to have a normal family with his boys?
I don't know. I think there's something to it. I mean, I know this movie was also inspired from Peter Pan and Peter Pan's Lost Boys, you know, and it's all about, you know, Peter bringing Wendy to Neverland and living with them and all this stuff. So I think, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, Diane West's character Lucy that he's trying. I mean, I guess he's trying to bring in for that motherly role, but it's like it's also kind of joined by Star as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a weird family dynamic that's going on. But then again, who am I to question what vampires are going to do with their family dynamics?
And then Star is a half vampire.
Yes, and so is Laddie.
Yeah. Man, Jamie Gertz.
Love Jamie Gertz.
She's the owner of the part, her husband, she and her owner, husband own the Atlanta Hawks.
I know.
Isn't that crazy?
Talk about doing well.
No, but I guess, but then she brings in Michael, you know, the smoldering Michael, because she likes him. But what did she expect from this? She probably wanted him to be turned, right?
So I read some interesting things on fandom from this, and they must have had some psychologist writing up this whole character review of Star. And I think part of this is also revealed, part of her background is also revealed in the novelization, which I really want to read and try to get my hands on. But apparently she's a runaway. Oh. And so she's, her father had, I don't know if her father abused her or was doing something, and then her mother tried to kill her, and so then she just took off and left and wound up in Santa Carla and got brought into this vampire gang with David and his boys. And I think part of that is her genuinely being interested in Michael, but also trying to escape that lifestyle that she's now stuck in.
Oh, find an out, and then he's the one that can
trying
help.
To find an out. And then I think part of it, she's interested in him, and then I think you have this weird thing going on where David originally wants her to kill Michael and to be her first kill, which then in turn would turn her into a full-blown vampire.
Mm.
But then I think she falls for him, and David ends up seeing Michael as somebody that he can recruit. And so then they go through that whole crazy initiation phase.
Got it. And so it just, the plan goes a little awry.
Yes, I would say so.
Man. So I just read something. I have so many, the problem with this movie is there's too many notes. But it just, Schumacher said that he wanted to direct this because he just read about vampires being young and sexy. Like, that's been, like, that's kind of what he based this movie around, right?
It's such a simplistic take, and now 30 years later, people are still, like, dissecting it for information. It's nuts.
I mean, I guess it's smart, though, like, just the way he tackled it, because it is quite subversive, this movie, but then it also, you can see the DNA of this in a lot of different movies. And I gotta tell you, I love the Frog Brothers in this. They're violent little guys. They murder a vampire. They go into a vampire lair, and that stake goes through Alex Winter really easily.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, they almost went right, you know, the whole stake almost went right through him, including the arm. Like, that was a heck of a spear by Corey Feldman.
Now, imagine you and I were 15 years old, right? We're the Frog Brothers. We live in this town. We know there are vampires. We know the comic books. I mean, the town that they film in was the murder capital of the world because of the serial killers that were there that were preying on the people that it was a town where people went, like homeless kids, runaways. So there was a big commuter population there. So if someone went missing, you probably wouldn't know. So the serial killers were preying on that. So they played with that aspect with these vampires. But we're 15 years old. And we're killers, but you and I just go into the vampire's cave in the morning and just kill one? Like, that's, the Frog Brothers are,
dude, they've got some big you-know-whats. I mean, they've, you know, they're brave. I don't know, it's really interesting because they do have times where
they're hugging each other.
Incredibly scared.
Yeah.
It's like, I think when they kill Paul in the bathtub at the end, like, they're freaking out. But then, yeah, earlier in the movie, you know, I guess 10 minutes before, they just strut right into that cave ready to kill everybody. But I also think that's part of their arrogance, is they don't know what to expect outside of what they have read in the comic books.
It messed with us. He looked at us and talked to us. And that messed with our plans.
Yes. blame it on a guy reacting to getting stabbed in the heart.
Oh, man, that was a lot of blood, too. But I guess I do like how they're... This is another thing I miss about movies of the 80s. So you have the Goonies. You have Stand By Me, you have this, where there are characters, teenagers, who kind of exist in their own world. I mean, 80s parents were notoriously terrible in movies, so they're not around, so kids can go on adventures. And, like, Batteries not included. There were a lot more kids going on adventure movies back in the day. And this one, yeah. I guess, is, man, you're 14, 15 watching this movie, and you see these Frog Brothers going in and killing vampires, you're going to relate to these guys. You're going to, like, because it's new. Like, you have these foul-mouthed vampire killers that are in way over their heads, but they still get the job done. And I guess I kind of like that about them. And then you have Nanook wiping people. Nanook saved the day.
Yeah. Yes, Paul, she did.
What do you think about
times.
What do you think about the death of Dwayne? He gets the arrow, then death by
He's
stereo.
The one, death by stereo. I love all the deaths in the movie. And I think that's part of it, is that Edgar, Corey Feldman's character, also mentions that no vampire goes out the same way. Some of them explode, some of them implode,
yeah.
Some of them, like, burn up, and some mm-hmm. go quietly, which I think he ends up getting all of those pretty much spot on. So I don't, Dwayne's is pretty funny, just for the fact that that Corey Haim Sam hits him somewhere with the first arrow and he drops. And then he stands up and he's like, "You missed, sucker." It's like you get that awful 80s dialogue where he's saying that he missed the shot. And then Haim says something to the effect of like, "Not this time." And then shoots him and drives him into a stereo that catches him on fire and blows his arms off. And it's really over the top. Very over the top.
So you have in this movie, there's four main vampires in their crew, and the kids do most of the killing in this. So you have Alex Winter, Marco being staked. Then you have Paul being killed by the Frog Brothers in the Nook. Then you have Sam killing Dwayne. David gets impaled in antlers by Michael. But it's kind of neat how it's the kids saving the day in this movie. The kids getting the kills. So, I mean, this is an R-rated movie, but I also think it played pretty heavy with the teenage crowd or younger crowd. Because you could, you know, you're a comic book loving kid. You see this movie and you're like, man, like, this is one of the first movies that made comic book kids kind of cool.
Yeah.
I know that they had to, so Schumacher told Corey Feldman to butch up his performance so he watched Clint Eastwood and Chuck Norris and Stallone movies. But I love just their voice. We're tough. But they're funny, too. But I like that he told him to butch it up. It's, I don't know. It's just another reason why the movie's still popular today. And they're still doing panels. Did you see on YouTube? They have big panels that they do together. And there'll be like 1,000 people sitting there listening to them talk.
Well, and I think every year, where was this shot at? The Santa Cruz Boardwalk. Every year they do like a big Lost Boys festival where a lot of these guys and actors, cast members, musicians will come back and perform and talk at this giant festival that they do.
Go watch Tim Capello play?
Oh, I would.
Oh, man.
I'd do it.
But I guess this movie too, it has such a simplistic plot. It's really, I like that it doesn't get convoluted. You have a single mom and her two kids moving into town with her father. The kid, Michael, immediately meets Star. He immediately gets in with this group. He almost immediately becomes a vampire. His brother suspects something. He teams up with two guys he finds at a comic shop, and then it all just ends at the end. It's such a simple, non-dragged into the muck narrative.
It is, and for the most part, it's all driven forward by the characters and the unique situations they find themselves in.
Yeah, the train sequence where they fall.
Oh yeah, the whole initiation thing I think is fascinating too.
What was the fog budget on this movie?
Oh man, it had to be a lot, especially that mountain. So it starts off with the dirt bike race to the cliff edge. A lot of fog there. Then they go back. I think there's a little fog in the collapsed hotel, which is an absolutely incredible set piece, by the way.
Oh, the cavernous set.
Yes, the Lost Boys' home or lair is a hotel from 1906 that collapsed into the ground following an earthquake.
With Jim Morrison on the wall.
Yes. Which I think it also it makes me wonder what the age of the Lost Boys is as well. Like, we know they're stuck around 17, 18 years old, but when were they originally transformed? Just makes me wonder if it is kind of that mid to late 60s period, especially with Jim Morrison poster.
Yeah.
Like, if that would have been big during the time that they turned, or if they just like all that retro stuff.
Take a guess. When do you think they turned?
Man, I would...
I don't think they're very good at it yet.
Says.
Does that make sense? Do you think they're good at it?
I don't know.
They sleep unprotected. They don't have a familiar protecting them when they sleep.
And they don't have a guard dog like Max's Thorn. But he's also been around since the 1900s.
Yeah.
Early 1900s.
Maybe they're overconfident teenagers still, right?
I think they're overconfident.
Yeah, they don't think that the Frog Brothers are going to come in there and just stab them in the chest.
Because they kill a lot of people early on in that movie.
The punks, the security guard. With the cheap camera trick, they couldn't afford stuff, so they just had a camera in the air.
Yeah, and then the couple making out in the car.
Oh, they ripped the top off.
They ripped the top off. And the guy's reading one of the comics he stole from the Frog Brothers.
Oh, never steal
and then,
comics.
Then they kill the whole rival biker gang. I mean, they destroy them.
Yeah, wipe them off.
Gosh, and that is such a brutal scene, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's bad.
I remember watching that for the first time and just thinking, like, oh my god, this is horrifying.
This, like, the sense of helplessness too, as the camera closes in on, you.
Yeah.
It's almost Evil Dead-esque, but not as Sam Raimi-y. It's more of like a stock floaty thing coming towards you.
So it's really interesting, now that we're talking about that, the camera work of this movie, especially like with that initiation scene where David's telling Michael that they're all murderers and they have to feed to live, I guess, or to continue to survive. But it's like all that camera work has just been building up, and it just kind of comes to a header right there during that massacre, that rave massacre. So it's like you get, as you mentioned, all these camera tricks of the flying, like the camera POV flying through the air. So I guess it's a POV of the vampires as they're moving. And so for the first, what, hour plus of the movie, we never actually see one of the vampires flying in the air or like what they're capable of. Everything is always left up to the imagination, is just off screen. So it's like, even when they're going in to kill somebody, you're getting the reaction of those people, but then they're getting pulled off screen. And so it's always just kind of left up to what you think is going on, or like how they go out is left in your mind's eye. And then it comes to that rave and it just hits so hard.
Yeah. They just go, they're bite. Like, I know it was earlier, but they're biting heads in blood. That was Keither's idea, the head bite.
Oh, just right on the top of the head.
Yeah. And then,
I mean,
just,
that's gnarly.
You got the fog and the fire and just people being ripped to shreds and the helplessness of it all.
But I love the camera tricks, especially when David is talking to Michael of how, you know, now you know what we are. And like he's talking from the shadows, and then you start to see his eyes start to red and yellow up, and then he leans into the light and he's morphed completely into a vampire. It's just the camera work is so sly and so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what keeps this thing relevant.
The final battle. Remember when I sent you the message to take a look at that, how there's a lot of just quick zooms in and how everything gets tighter on their faces. And it's kind of heightened the way they play it. I mean, this movie, I mean, listen, you bring in Michael Chapman, who did Raging Bull and Taxi Driver, you're going to get some good work in here.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, once again, I think this is another case of, they do a good job with the psychology of it too. To save money on the budget, they had the POV shot. But that's even scarier, because you're seeing, like, when Sam is running out there to save Nanook, I have been watching that scene for 20 years, and it still gets me every time. I'm like, get Nanook in!
Michael!
Yeah.
You're coming, Michael! Run, Michael!
Oh, so many people yelling,
Michael!
Michael! Michael, Michael! But yes, it's just those tricks, and at the end, just the quick zoom-ins on the faces, when they know how to pull back, they know how to pull in, they know how to kind of get the romantic shots of that, how to frame each character. I mean, a lot of this stuff is lit with, you know, at night you have a lot of fires lighting the scenes. You have just a lot of different interesting warm colors. And I like what Schumacher said when they were shooting one of the scenes. He's like, I'm going to be doing all nights. This sucks. Which I thought was really funny. Schumacher had this realization that you and I have worked some nights. Well, have we? We've worked. Okay. No, we've just worked late into the night. We haven't worked full nights, have we?
You and I haven't. I have.
Because you and I...
We never did together, I don't think.
I was with you for a couple nights on Resurrection, and we worked nights. But that wasn't a night shoot. That was just a split, maybe.
Yeah, that was like... Yeah, that would have been like a split. Yeah, getting off at 3 or 4 in the morning.
Dude, nights are a different world.
Nights are horrible.
But I guess what's good, though, is that Schumacher had a bunch of young kids on this movie that were hungry and wanted to work. Well, Patrick turned it down about 47 times from what I heard. And he brought Gertz in because of the play that he did with her. But yeah, I mean, you have a young crew, you have a hungry crew, young kids. I mean, I bet the shoot was pretty wild, I would say, but you had a lot of energy from these up and comers. So it probably wasn't too bad, right? Just working on this thing.
And I think they shot it in 3 weeks.
Yeah, they shot it fast.
So, I mean, that is incredibly fast for a feature film.
Well, Schumacher, dude, he turned in Batman Forever under budget and I think on time or before time. But you watch Batman Forever and you're thinking to yourself, how did someone do this under budget? It blows my mind that he did that movie on time and under budget. And so I guess he got a good start with this film knocking that stuff out.
I'm just thinking of the 3 week shooting period too. So I mean, what we did, Game of Your Life, which was an NBC movie of the week.
How long did that take?
I think that was roughly 20 days. So that's a 4 week shoot.
Wait, for an NBC movie, it was 4 weeks?
Yeah, I believe so.
I think Hallmark can knock them out in 2 weeks.
I'd have to go back and look at the call sheet, but I remember it roughly being around 20 days.
Wow.
And I mean, just thinking that an NBC movie of the week takes longer to shoot than The Lost Boys. So that just shows you, I think, how well they prepped this thing and what Schumacher knew what he wanted to do going into it.
I mean, you look at these shots at when they're out at night, they purposely make it really dark. They shroud it in the smoke so you can't see that much more. And I think maybe he knew what to hide, so you didn't need big wide shots at night.
Yeah.
Right? So I think there's smart decisions you can make.
And outside of a bunch of establishing shots, that's pretty – yeah, I mean, you're spot on. There's a bunch of establishing shots, especially early on, where a lot of aerial photography. And I think that also eats up some serious camera time too, because it almost turns in – you know, he's always got music blasting to that, so it's becoming a music video simultaneously. But you're right. Like, outside of the establishing shots and the big wides, everything to do with a character is usually tight, medium shots up on him.
Just knock it
out.
You've got
Tim Capello's big song and the big party on the boardwalk, but then that's it. Everything else is 3 days. Confined.
Yeah, 3 days with that. So that's not, because you have the comic book location, and then you have the couple houses, and then the big lair. But they don't spend much time there. Well, yeah, they have a big scene in there where he's kind of getting Michael to drink.
Yeah.
A lot of scenes at that house.
Yeah, most of the movies at the house. And then, you know, you've got – and then when the Frog Brothers and Sam realize that they've got to prep for the final battle, you know, they're doing their little errands and runs. And, you know, they go to a church and fill up their canteens with holy water.
Oh, that's the funniest scene. I love those guys.
In the middle of a baptism.
And they're just—they bring a canteen to soak up the water. Oh, I love it!
They put holy water in their squirt guns.
And then the pool of the tub of garlic. But that's
which I'm not sure. I'm not sure if garlic actually worked though. Did it?
Well, the vampire got pushed into it, and it.
He got pushed into it, but most holy of it water. I think was from the holy water.
Wait, they. So I think, oh yeah.
Because I think they've got. Don't they hold garlic up to Paul or something like that? And he's like, that doesn't work. And then they splash the holy water on his face
and
it starts to melt him away.
And then they just splash him. Then he gets that cool makeup effect of the water on his face. Nanook wipes him out.
Skin off.
And then they tried to do it to Max, but this is another interesting thing about the mythology is where Max gets invited and then the normal tricks don't work on him.
Yes. I forgot about that earlier.
I love it though, right?
So I wrote down a list of rules or like vampire laws that this movie have listed out. And so number one, I've got like dog guardians. Dogs are the guardians unless owned by someone else. So it's interesting, like Thorn is Max's guardian and he's a vampire. So he guards his master, but then Nanook guards a human. So it's like you also have that split guardianship where they're. It just shows, I guess, they're fiercely loyal to their owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wood and the stake through the heart will kill a vampire. They're susceptible to holy water. They do not have a reflection. And they don't go full vamp until after first kill. And then the sixth rule, all above rules do not imply if they're invited into a house.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
So in this world, there's definitely a god, correct? Because holy water works.
Yeah, there must be.
So this is a, you know how in some zombie movies it's like a virus or this is just a supernatural curse or a blessing for somebody. So there's, okay, but those guys that broke into their house, were they invited? So then holy water shouldn't have worked.
They were not invited.
So how'd they get in the house?
They broke in. Paul appeared suddenly upstairs, so... You have to assume he came through a window. Dwayne busted through the fireplace.
But does that mean, okay, so if you're not invited in, you can just kick the door in? But then that means you're not susceptible. You're still, okay, you can kick the door in, but that means holy water can kill you. But if you're invited in, holy water doesn't kill you.
Yes, I think it's kind of their trickery that if they're invited, if they can get somebody to invite them into the house or invite them onto a premises, then they pretty much can do whatever they want. They're invincible, more or less.
So what's the supernatural power?
So,
like, what's the supernatural power then? Okay, so the supernatural power knows you were invited. So then that holy water...
What you're getting at. Yeah.
So what's the switch? And I love it, by the way, because they say it in the movie, so it makes sense. But I like that there's some form of demonic power or shield or cloak.
It must be some sort of, yeah, I guess, I think I like your term, the demonic shield that is triggered on persuasiveness or invitation. And I think that also goes into, you know, what these vampires do and how they persuade, influence other people to, you know, go against their will or do something they don't want to do, or their hallucinatory powers as well.
I mean, he almost drives Michael off of a cliff.
Yeah.
Man, Michael. So many Michaels.
118 of them.
Oh, I love it. So how about this? Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will talk more The Lost Boys. We'll be right back.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And I just enjoyed some delicious Oreo cookies and root beer. Tom enjoyed some maggots. How were they?
Maggots and worms. They're worms, Michael. You're eating worms.
They're pretty good.
I love noodles.
They just put them in a thing. They just put in a box of maggots.
Box of maggots and worms. Hey, it's protein. It'll get you by.
Yeah, I guess. What would you rather have, maggots or Oreos and a root beer?
Oreos and a root beer, for sure. But it's tough. Now that you mention it, that's a tough thing. So I've got a serious question for you here.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of times we like to talk about strategy and being tactical, especially in battles with some of our podcasts that we do, and how smart characters are to get things to go the way they need them to go. Does Sam, Michael, and the Frog Bros make a huge tactical blunder by killing Marco, by going into the cave and killing Marco? Because I'm asking, because right after they kill him and they get back to the surface, they realize that sunset is coming up. And the vampire's going to be coming after them in just a couple hours. So why did they do that at like 5 p.m.?
They're kids, right?
Just dumb kids.
Now, when you and I were 15 years old, right, we did not think step B, right? We weren't proactive at that age, I think. We were dumb kids fueled by... And the Frog Brothers, they don't... They're more brawn than brain. I would say.
I don't think they really have any brain.
So they just jumped into it because they're kids. I think they just went and did it. They wanted to do it, so they did it. Why didn't they just throw a Molotov cocktail in there? Why didn't they just light it on fire, all their stuff?
They probably should have. Yeah. Or brought in, like, high-powered flashlights and just burned them up.
I mean, tactically, horrible idea, right? But I guess we can allow 15-year-olds...
Cinematically, it's great.
Yeah.
It works out well. It crams the action together.
It's just 15-year-old kids. I don't think we can be too... Does that make sense? I don't think we can be too hard on them for doing that.
Other than them almost getting each other killed, but yeah.
I mean, would Marco and them have gone after them that night? Would they have known to go chase them down?
Probably not. They probably would have let them be for a few nights.
Yeah.
I mean, so they could have really made some kick-ass sweet plan, and then they just kind of rushed it.
Yeah, but...
And then blundered it with Marco's slaying.
I think they're just kids.
Or right? Alex Winter.
Yeah, he got... That was such a bloody death. The squirming of it. It was a... That's a violent, brutal death. I like, too, their vampire feet. So these... Are their feet always vampiric, or only vampiric when they turn into their bat form?
I think they've kind of got control over it. I think they've... Because it's... You also see when they morph, so I don't think... I mean, they're all still wearing their shoes and their boots when they morph into their vampire form. So I don't think that their big, long bat feet would fit in regular shoes.
Yeah.
So I think they probably have control over, you know, what they need to when they're hanging upside down, sleeping.
Does the blood not get to their brains?
For them, it probably doesn't matter. They don't have blood in them. They're not pumping any. Well, they must, because they're shooting blood out when they die.
Yeah, and they're drinking it.
Some sort of sludge.
Yeah, that was sludgy, wasn't it? It was a goo.
It was just a goop.
Oh,
just a goopy mess. So I would have loved to see the scene, though, where they all drop back down after Marco's death, and they have to put their shoes on before they fly away.
Hold up! Hold on, put on our sneaks!
Gotta lace up my big boots with the 35 lace straps on them.
The pumps, the Reebok pumps?
Yes.
No, but I think that adds more to... That's what I like about this movie, though, is... We're learning with the characters as we go along. And I like that. Like, with Max, it's kind of fun that everyone's sort of on the same page as we're going on this adventure with them. Does that make sense? I think it adds another element to why it's so rewatchable. These aren't all-knowing kids, and they aren't totally stupid kids. We're just learning. And a lot of times... You know how they talk about what Hitchcock talked about suspense and what a jump scare? So you either two people are having lunch and a bomb explodes, you jump. Or you see the bomb under the table when two people sit down, that creates suspense. I think this one's more of just we're just on the journey with them, I guess. They never show you the bomb, but then there's never that big explosion either, I guess. Am I losing you here?
No, I get it. I would agree with it.
Like Predator. We're learning with them.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And I think that's kind of the whole point of it is they're, you know, it's just a day in the lives of these kids that find themselves in this really extraordinary circumstance.
Man, those Frog Brothers, they're sociopaths. I love them.
They are nuts. I think they're really bad movies, but I want to watch the sequels.
I really think I watched the second one. I do. That's the one with Feldman?
Yeah.
I watched that one. I did. And then they bring back brand new people for the third one. The Lost Boys second one has a budget for a DTV movie. It's not cheap.
I'll have to check it out. It's streaming somewhere right now for free. I saw it. Like I don't know if it was on Vudu with the free ads or what it was, but I'm going to have to check it out.
Oh, and here's what I read. I found this on Reddit. And so someone wrote, I think it's like a family tree. Kill a vampire. And it frees those who have been infected by his curse, but haven't condemned themselves yet. Of course, for this to work, we presume the bottle of wine that David infected Michael with was actually Max's blood. But that's believable enough, as it appears that becoming a vampire only requires drinking the blood, not being bitten yourself, and then completing the curse by killing someone else and drinking their blood as well. Once you're a full vampire, killing your creator won't cure you. So the head vampire just refers to vampire in power, the local bigwig.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But when does the curse know? What kind of curse? Like, that's what I love about it. There's a demonic presence fulfilling this curse?
Yeah, it's got to be. I mean, the curse, I mean, I guess the curse just knows. It knows what's going on. It's up with the times.
It's up with the times?
It's complicated.
It's hip. But that, like I said, that's another thing I like about this movie with Schumacher is he knows what he wanted out of this movie and he created it. And I kind of like, in the 80s, right, there weren't too many in these comedies. It was always married parents, was it not? Weren't the parents, wasn't it always a nuclear family? And then you have issues?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of neat seeing the single mom in this one. And then the kind of runaways.
The recently divorced.
So it kind of
Academy Award winning Diane West.
Oh, it's crazy. And I guess they blew up the variation of the nuclear family in this by creating a vampiric family. But then what's funny is you have Max and then you have the mom, but Max wants to create a nuclear family. That's like his goal.
Max just wants to settle down.
So he just wants Diane Weiss to take care of everything, right?
He just wants some love and affection. I mean, he's just misunderstood. He's probably a decent guy. Things got a little out of hand. No, he's a total turd. I can't defend him.
Yeah, I was like, what? I was like, I want to see where this goes from. But yeah, once again, but I guess, you know what's interesting talking about this movie is there's so much research to this film, but there's also, it's also refreshing because there's not much there either. I'm not hating on this movie, but it's just such a simple tale. But I think that's what makes it watchable. I think this movie flies by. This doesn't feel like a chore watching.
No, there's always something going on with it.
All right, and then I found another thing here that I want to read to you that I kind of want you... So you sent me that really cool thing about the character. And Tim Capello just showed up in his own clothes, which I love, too, the saxophonist.
You mean he showed up in pants.
Yeah, showed up in pants and ponytail.
And jeans.
A vampire hotel. I love those lines. What does he say? Like a shit butt? Doesn't he call?
Something like that.
Oh, I love that line. But let's see. It's going to be a solid team. The makeup spot, the people who did the makeup, Greg Cannon.
Yeah, oh, man, and so Zay Nell, I believe her name is.
So
I think
good.
Was the head of the makeup department. And then Cannon was the head of the special effects makeup.
So, you know, that what's interesting is Alex Winter, because this movie could have gone wrong in a lot of ways, would you say?
Oh, yeah.
And
definitely could have.
Alex Winter is quoted as saying, it was impossible to see it working. He said, let's take all these standard rules of vampire lore and let's squeeze them through almost like a big gaudy 80s teen sex comedy or sex drama. And I was like, that's not going to work in spades. But I don't want to retread ground. But this movie could have gone wrong. This could have been this could have leaned too far into camp. This could have leaned too far into humor, but it strikes a good balance. I mean, it's 79% of Rotten Tomatoes. What, 7.3 on IMDb? Yeah, 7.3. So, we've already talked about what makes it iconic, but what were some choices that Schumacher and crew and Jeffrey Boehm, the guy who wrote, you know, Indiana Jones and in the Last Crusade, what decisions do they make that made this movie what it is, would you say?
I think for how grounded it is, at least for the first 60, 65, maybe 70 minutes, how grounded it is. It's after that, when they finally get to the house, when the Lost Boys show up at Grandpa's house, that things really get out of control. So I think, at least for me, that's what makes it so believable and keeps you with it, is that it doesn't go too crazy in one direction. As you mentioned, you know, they could have really gone super campy with it and cheesy and corny. They could have really taken it in a humorous direction, but instead they find just enough balance with the humor, the one-liners, you know, some of the practical jokes, and then also the horror and the scariness to it. So I think it's just a really nice juxtaposition of all those elements. So I guess you go too dark and too hard, it's just going to be way too brooding. It's going to be hard to sit through 90 minutes of that.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of those movies that this can work as a date night, but it also can work as a horror hound watching a movie because they like vampires.
Right? Yeah.
So it kind of... Remember Interview with the Vampire? That movie was massive, but I mainly think it was because of the star power of Cruise and Pitt at the time. But that was a sulky, bloody, moody piece.
Yeah, and that thing slogged on at times, too.
Yeah, and this one just moves on. I think you're right. It's just an MTV music video stretched out to 97 minutes.
You know, I think they knew their audience target, too. I mean, obviously this was made, you know, when we were infants, it came out. So, I mean, we wouldn't have been watching it then. But it's like, if it finds that viewership, you know, in the teenage years, those people are going to continue to love it for the rest of their life. So it's like, I don't think I could get my parents to watch it and they would enjoy it. I think they're way past that point.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I could get my niece or nephew. Well, my niece might. She's now a teenager. But like my nephew, who's 10, like I don't think he would watch it and enjoy it. So it's like, I think you've got to get that target age, that sweet spot, and you're going to enjoy it. And that's what they went for.
Find it on DVD. Watch it. And then it's aged well, too, because everything is just in... Everything is in camera in this movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I dig that about it. And also, you know, the costume designer of this did Vision Quest.
Ooh.
Hey.
Classic movie, too.
And also St. Elmo's Fire. And Days of Thunder. And Flatliners.
I find it really interesting that... Didn't Schumacher do St. Elmo's Fire before this? Like, yeah. Right before this?
He did, yeah.
I mean, that's a slog fest, too.
Oh, yeah, it's a slog.
I mean, that's a two-hour soap opera right there with high star power in it.
They were just, I think they were just smart. Like, what do you think there are other movies that are this long that go by so quickly? Because this one flies. Do you think there's a... I know I'm reaching here, but I guess what I'm saying is I like how brisk everything moves in this movie.
Yeah, no, I mean, the energy stays up through the whole thing. I mean, even in the slower moments when it's just like Sam and Michael, but every time you kind of hit a slower patch, it's the characters that keep it going forward. And they're always so charismatic. There's always something still going on that I think just keeps you compelled.
There's no adjustment period to this town. These kids move in and they're automatically in the thick of it. There's no, you know, move to a new town, meet friends or bullies on each other. That doesn't happen at all in this movie.
Apparently there's no school either.
Yeah. There's no, like, this movie's just meat and potatoes, I guess. Yeah. What is it? Summer, I guess, for them?
It must be the summer. I was thinking about that a few minutes ago.
And also, I think another thing that Schumacher did that was smart. I mean, he just cast a bunch of good-looking people for this movie, too. He went out to do that. And he said he had... he said, I've hired these young, sexy kids, and I want them sexy. And then he said that he had the best cast that he could find. I mean, Kiefer Sutherland was really committed to this. He had some good lines. I mean, Jamie Gertz and... Jason Patrick were just like good looking kids at the time. Then you had all the model vampires. And then you had the scrappy frog brothers taking them out.
And then you have, you know, yeah. And then you had Corey Haim. Has launched the Coreys.
Man, I feel so bad watching all this stuff behind the scenes and hearing about these kids' lives. Bruce Campbell said that if you're a child actor, you're either selling cocaine in Miami or you're doing pretty good. Like he said about Kurt Russell. But, yeah, I mean, whenever I see the Coreys on screen now, it kind of makes me sad, man. I don't know. Well, it's bittersweet, is it not?
Yeah, I won't say that their movies were that great. I always enjoyed Dream a Little Dream. But, I mean, you know, it's just, you know, not to get too melancholy or, you know, dark with that stuff. But they were two kids that enjoyed making movies with each other that went through some really awful stuff.
Yeah. And then I guess they didn't. What's the word? Age well, I guess, or they just, and then they kind of got cast aside. It's a gnarly story, man. I hate hearing. Oh gosh, there was a documentary about the two Coreys. Breaks your heart.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, because their career, what they start well eight. No, I mean Feldman had a decent little run there for a while because he popped up in the Burbs in '90.
Yeah,
man, kid actors sucks. They those kids partied though.
He had a great little run there with Goonies, Stand By Me, then Lost Boys.
Ready to Drive.
Yeah, and apparently he was, and again, and just it's kind of that
Gremlins
sad, real story. I mean, apparently he was on cocaine during this, and he was really struggling, and Schumacher fired him.
Yep.
And then he came back, I guess, like the next day and brought him back if he could clean himself up, and he did.
Wow. And this... He was so young at the time on this.
I know. That's the 80s stuff right there. I mean, it's a whole other world.
Yeah, the cocaine. It's a hell of a drug.
Man.
All right, so how about this? Let's do something real quick. Let's do a quick draft. And since we're talking about a lot of 80s movies, let's do an 87 draft.
Ooh, an 87 draft.
1987 draft. So, I'll let you go first.
Okay, I gotta look up 1987 movies.
I just did 1987 draft. That won't get to me where do I need to be. All right, so 1987 movies.
Oh, so, man, there's some great movies.
Yeah, it's a great year, actually. I know some people who say it's the best year ever for movies, too.
So I'm going to go with if you're giving me first pick, I'm going to go with what we've been talking about. I'm going to go bold here and go big. I'm going to go with the 1987 Saturn Award winner best horror film, The Lost Boys.
Okay, so you're taking The Lost Boys? I mean, there's Princess Bride, but that feels so obvious. I'll
stay away from Princess Bride if you are.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Oh, man, there's so many good movies. Oh, goodness. Oh, man, there's Predator.
Yep.
Masters of the Universe.
Man, there's a lot of good movies.
All right, RoboCop.
Oh, that's a good one.
I'm trying not to go too obvious, right? But you can take whatever the heck you want. I don't care.
And you know what? I think they lost Best Makeup. Lost Boys lost the Best Makeup Saturn Award to RoboCop, I believe.
Good.
I'm going to go Raising Arizona.
No, that was my pick. Oh, man. I was just looking at that. That's evil. That's funny you said that. All right, Raising Arizona. Oh, gosh. Hey, is Lethal Weapon too obvious?
No.
Spaceballs.
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to go Untouchables.
Oh, no. I'm missing so many movies. All right, Untouchables. Oh, that's a strong pick. All right, so I need to go big here. It's a great pick.
Oh,
baby
gosh.
Falling down a staircase for 45 minutes. Let's see.
Yes. And then there's the greatest slide in human history to stop that little the baby from falling down.
I'll do Hellraiser.
That's good, too. Oh, man.
All right, is Full Metal Jacket too obvious?
No, I don't think so. I don't think a lot of people would realize that came out in 87.
All right, so anything's game. Take what you want.
I'm going to go Stakeout.
Oh.
Love that movie. I watched it. I rewatched it again a few weeks ago. That movie is so fun.
All right, since you did that, I'm just going to take... I'm not going to do Over the Top. Let's do Over the Top. The Witches of Eastwick. This is insane this year. You know what? Since you did Stakeout, I'll do Masters of the Universe. I'll have some fun with it.
Beastmaster?
Masters of the Universe.
Oh, Masters of the Universe. Okay. Oh, boy. All right.
This is gnarly. The Last Emperor, dude.
Running Man.
Yeah. Beverly Hills Cop 2, Dirty Dancing, Wall Street.
Moonstruck, Living Daylights.
Yep.
Good
Nightmare
morning.
On Elm Street 3, that's actually a really good one. Prince of Darkness, Monster Squad.
I'm gonna go Wall Street.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a really good one. So right now you have Lost Boys, Raising Arizona, Untouchables, Stakeout, and Wall Street. I'm done. I have RoboCop, Spaceballs, Hellraiser, Masters of the Universe. And I'm gonna do Full Metal Jacket as a Hail Mary. How's that sound? To keep it close.
You'd say Full Metal Jacket. Wait, did you get Predator?
No, I wanted to leave that one out. That's a ringer. You know when people do these tournaments and they just go for the super obvious ones? That's not fun to me. I'd rather lose and pick a funky squad.
Yeah. Fatal Attraction. Hamburger Hill.
Yeah, it's insane.
We could do a whole pod over just 87 movies.
So what's your final thoughts about Lost Boys? I mean, there's so much here. There's so much to talk, like so much behind the scenes stuff. But what's your final thoughts about this movie? What'd you think?
I'm going to say, people, just go watch the Saturn Award winner for Best Horror Film of 1987. I'm going to keep saying that because I think that's like the only award that it won, and it should have won all of them. It's just fun. To me, it's timeless. It is the quintessential 1980s movie.
Yeah.
I just think it's great. Everything from the camera work to the music. It's just, it's so fun. I almost rewatched it again this morning.
Give me your three favorite scenes.
Three favorite scenes. The rave, the Tim Capello jazz fest. I love the exploding bathtubs
yes.
and the toilets.
Like, oh,
how
yeah,
gross
water
that
everywhere.
Is.
Oh.
And how, I meant to touch on that earlier, like how that makes absolutely no sense, how Paul could generate that much fluid from his body that he's going to blow the water lines in the entire house. And then I'm going to say the David Michael fight. Because it's like you finally actually see the vampires flying around and colliding in midair.
They saved their budget for that.
Yeah. And then, I don't know, and I guess to go along with David's death when he's actually dying and morphs back to a human, and you've got Cry Little Sister playing over the top of that. Like, that wants... He's a bad guy, and I want to shed a tear for him.
That's a good song, too.
It's a really good song. Really booty.
Okay, so I'm not going to step on yours. You didn't... I love the garlic... Or I love the holy water bath. You got to stick with that. I love the grandpa. I love him making a steak in the background.
Yes.
You got to go with that. And then I guess the final one is just watching poor Alex Winter writhe in death pains after getting stabbed through a fence post. That's a gnarly scene. So those are my three.
And for a kicker then, for our fourth one, I think we can throw in how random it is that Grandpa then walks to the fridge after he kills Max and grabs a root beer out of his shelf that's designated just for his sodas.
Yeah, don't touch my root beer. And don't you know about the rules about filling up the tank after you take my car after not asking?
And I love how the camera, it just, everything fades to black, and it's from the light closing from the fridge on the Emerson family, just staring at Grandpa like, what the hell just happened?
Drinking his root beers. Yeah,
I love it.
And it just builds another world. And I think most good movies do that. Look at Star Wars, right? Predator. You just throw in that line and you have another world entirely, another backstory. And then, oh, it's perfect. That's one line just causing building a mythology. I dig it. Well, thank you for joining me, man.
Thank you.
All right. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Tom Saxman, Tresemmer, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.